Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
A name and a number to start us off today, Bernanke and 353. The chairman of the Fed, of course, and today's point drop on the Dow. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
This podcast is supported by Netflix Instant Streaming. Thousands of TV episodes and movies on your computer or mobile device instantly streamed by Netflix to save you time, money, and hassle. Free 30-day trial now at netflix.com/APM.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Thursday today, the 20th of June. This is our podcast. Glad you could be with us. And hey, I get how it works now. Ben Bernanke gives a press conference, says generally positive things, and the world explodes. I speak, of course, about yesterday's Fed meeting and the ensuing market reaction, but let's remember the takeaway from that meeting, shall we? That the economy is actually doing better, so the Fed can stop greasing the skids, pumping money in, gradually, to be sure. And yet, Wall Street loses its beans. The Dow dropped hard yesterday, harder today, and don't even get me started on bonds, people. From New York, Marketplace's Sabri Benishour gets us going.
When Ben Bernanke was giving his press conference, guess what triggered the markets to fall? Was it the word doom? Was it interest rate hike? No.
Markets stumbled as Chairman Bernanke was using the word optimistic.
That's Quincy Crosby, chief strategist for Prudential.
It does sound odd, but markets being what they are, they just say, sell first, ask questions later.
If the economy was a party the past few years, that party sucked. So the Fed has been dumping vodka into the punch bowl, i.e. pumping cash into the economy. Now that the Fed is optimistic about the party, it can pour a little less liquor into the bowl, meaning slow down on the quantitative easing. Dan Greenhouse is chief global strategist for BTIG.
There is this belief that the Fed's pumping of liquidity into the system has helped drive up the prices of stocks.
So if you're an investor, you might be thinking,
check, please.
It's time to leave the party. Maybe some of your stocks have been overvalued.
So on the idea that the Fed would provide less liquidity, however modest that might be, investors are using this as a chance to sell some of their holdings that presumably have gone higher.
So does this mean the stock market knows something about the economy that we don't? No, says Mark Spindell with Potomac River Capital.
The economy should continue to do fine, but I think the investor base is a little bit more demanding and maybe a little bit less patient.
This sort of correction happens anytime there's a major policy shift, he says. And hopefully the party will go on. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Repeat after me, people. The Dow is not the economy. The economy is not the Dow. All right. As the Senate wades through amendment after amendment after amendment to the immigration bill, there is one amendment that's just a little bit unusual. It would set aside 30,000 green cards for people who work in fields traditionally dominated by women, healthcare and childcare, to name just a couple of them. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer has that story.
The immigration bill would change the way green cards are awarded, emphasizing work experience instead of family ties. Immigrants would get points for things like advanced degrees and technical skills. But Senator Mazie Hirono says that would make it tougher for women to get green cards. The Hawaii Democrat says in many countries, women don't have the chance to go to college.
We do not want to see this immigration bill basically set in concrete the unequal opportunities for women in these other countries.
So Hirono and 12 other female senators co-sponsored an amendment that would set up a new skill category, giving 30,000 green cards to people in fields dominated by women, like home health care and early education. But here's that tricky question. Are we reinforcing stereotypes? I asked Joanna Drebbe. She studies immigration and teaches sociology at the State University of New York at Albany.
I'm not sure that it perpetuates a stereotype, but it responds to reality of women's working conditions, fair or not.
Mary Giovannoli heads the Immigration Policy Center, a Washington think tank focusing on immigration. She agrees that the amendment acknowledges reality, but she says it also gives a little more respect to occupations dominated by women.
It's not reinforcing those stereotypes, but it's acknowledging that these jobs exist and that we need to give people credit for that work.
Giovannoli says especially since right now, most women immigrate to the U.S. because of family ties, not their jobs. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, well, I think we covered that already, didn't we? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Get a load of this as we turn to the continuing fallout from the NSA Edward Snowden story and how technology companies are working with the government. Back in 2010, the chief security officer at Facebook, a guy named Max Kelly, left that company. He had a new job, not Twitter, though, not Google. He went to work at the NSA. Nick Wingfield wrote the story in the New York Times today about the connection between Silicon Valley and government intelligence agencies. Nick, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
So I'll tell you, I read your piece and I was tempted to start with a question about how the NSA and Silicon Valley are strange bedfellows, but turns out not really. It's a little bit hand in glove.
Right. What we tried to show in the story was that the connections are really deep and operate on a lot of different levels. There's, you know, at the basis, both of these industries are really interested in big data and making sense of it for very different purposes, but a lot of the skill sets are the same, and so you see a lot of cooperation in different areas.
Does the NSA go out to Silicon Valley and go to, I don't know, jobs fairs or recruitment centers? How do they do this?
One of the most, colorful examples is at an industry conference that's usually dedicated to hackers called DEF CON last year. Keith Alexander, the head of the NSA, showed up and spoke at it. This is a guy who you normally don't see in anything but military uniforms, and he was wearing a black T-shirt and jeans.
So did he have a name tag on that said Keith Alexander, NSA?
I'm not sure about that, but name tags are seen frequently at these conferences, and they're trying to recruit these hackers to come help them with cybersecurity.
We know what's in it for the NSA. Right, they get data analytics experts. They get people who can do this stuff. They get access, in theory, to the data. What do the companies get, though?
They get a couple things. One is they get business. Government contracts can be very lucrative. The other thing is maybe more common sense. They, you know, if they get subpoenas or orders for information, they want to comply with it.
And in theory, control the process a little bit?
Yeah, they can manage that process better if they have people on the inside who have some experience with this. It's a fairly common thing for that to happen.
Do you know how much money the NSA spends out in Silicon Valley?
We don't know.
It's classified, right?
That's right.
Yeah, okay. It's not like this cooperation between Silicon Valley and the government is new. Hewlett-Packard built that first oscilloscope, I think, for the Defense Department or for the, you know, precursor to.
What we're seeing now really is a kind of convergence between the big data sets that the intelligence agencies are interested in and these big consumer internet services out there like Facebook and so on that also know a lot about you. I mean, they know a lot about you because they want to try and sell ads to you. Not to fight terrorism necessarily, but there's just been so many of these different services out there that have incredible mountains of data that it's gotten very interesting to the NSA and others.
Nick Wingfield is a reporter for the New York Times. He's based out in Seattle. He wrote today in the paper with James Risen about the NSA in Silicon Valley. Nick, thanks a bunch.
You bet.
Think for a second about food and about how it tastes in particular. The biggies of those tastes, sweet and salty, have helped create and sustain a massive industry in junk foods, or at the very least, foods that aren't all that healthy for us. There is, though, a whole different taste driving the business of what we eat now. Sour is riding high at the moment, as Marketplace's Mark Garrison reports from New York.
There's a ton of different things going on here.
Catherine Alford can see your food future. She runs Food Network's Test Kitchen. Her team takes cutting-edge food and figures out what's ready for prime time and daytime all across America.
We are working, as strangely as it may seem, on Thanksgiving in June, because you always work way far ahead of time.
Mouthwatering food is everywhere, flipping in skillets, plunging into deep fryers, and whipping around on carts. These days, sour flavor is abundant. Alford unscrews a jar and we crunch into some pickled carrots. Years ago, their pickle recipes had to be way sweeter. And the lemon vinaigrette she's whisking has lots more lemon than in the past. Food companies are cashing in. In 2007, Greek yogurt was a crunchy co-op item. Now, it's all over supermarket shelves with more than a third of the market. The second fastest growing beer style? Belgian sour, up 31%. More sour is the next step in our appetite for bigger, bolder flavors.
We've seen people willing to go to extremes with hot and spicy. Let's see how far we can get them to go with sour.
Mary Chapman tracks flavor trends for the food consultancy Technomic. Sour foods are also popular because of what they aren't: sweet. Kaja Jankowski is with Sterling Rice Group, which advises various global food companies. They're doing more with sour foods, in part because they strike consumers as healthier.
Taking that tart flavor and bringing it forward connotes that sense of, okay, this isn't a sugar-laden product.
So pucker up. More sour foods are coming to stores near you. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Mark wrote a companion story for Slate about this as well. We've got the link to it at our website. It's marketplace.org. Coming up.
If people were to look for breakout programming, it was no longer worthwhile to look to the broadcast networks.
Forget about it. But first, let's do the numbers. You knew there was going to be the wah-wah trombones, right? I mean, I could have told you that like this morning. The Dow Industrials plunged 2.3% today, 353 points, 14,758 the number. The NASDAQ threw off 2.25%, 78 points, 3364 at the bell. The S&P 500 erased 2.5%, 40 points, 1588 is the number you're looking for there. Some financial firms were even more depressed than the Dow. Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs, and Citigroup all withdrew between 3.5% and 4%. Bank of America and JP Morgan Chase both reversed about 2% today. Their bad day didn't come close to the one at Ebix. Shares in the software maker fell more than 40% after Goldman Sachs pulled the plug on a deal to buy that company. The up escalator was running as well. Clearwire shares climbed more than 7% today. Bonds, as I mentioned, they fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note, listen to this, everybody, pay attention, 2.42%. You're listening to Marketplace.
This podcast is supported by Netflix Instant Streaming. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your computer, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. Streamed now by Netflix, a great value. Netflix Streaming has lots of movie and television options, including past seasons of House of Cards, Breaking Bad, and Arrested Development. Watch them using Netflix Instant Streaming and find thousands of other TV series and movies during your free 30-day trial at netflix.com/APM.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up tomorrow. The nation's mayors are in Las Vegas for the U.S. Conference of Mayors annual meeting. Vice President Biden is scheduled to speak. Pollinator Week continues. The U.S. Department of Agriculture holds a festival about the birds and bees and bats and butterflies and other creatures that help our food supply. And it's the longest day of the year. You can get a lot done, although it's also Friday, which could be totally counterproductive. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We've got an occasional series running this summer with Youth Radio about the things that young people have to deal with when they go try to find work. Jobsticles is what we're calling it. Unemployment for teenagers is 24%. That is three times the national average. But sometimes, or honestly, more often probably, teenagers are their own worst enemies, as Ashley Williams reports.
Christian Hernandez recorded this joke voicemail greeting 3 years ago when he was 16.
Hello? Can't understand you.
The recording keeps going like this, tricking you into thinking that it's Hernandez on the phone. It's pretty convincing.
Ha, voicemail. You know what to do, stupid.
When teens apply for jobs, they rarely think about all the little things that could set them back. Like a voicemail calling a potential employer stupid. It's 3:05 on a Thursday at Skyline High School in Oakland, California. With barely 2 weeks left before summer break, students are bolting for the door. But I managed to quiz sophomores Ivan Johnson and Marina Wright on what they knew about soft skills.
How many words you can type per minute?
Your grammar?
Even I didn't know what they were. Most teens don't. But employers say soft skills are the first things they look for. Skills like follow-through and professional etiquette. Etiquette that Wright says many of her peers lack. Like when it comes to email addresses.
like bigbooty something at gmail.com.
My email's kind of inappropriate. It's iPacmanJohnson. My mom told me, it's like, dude, what are you doing making that email?
Johnson was 8 when he celebrated his love for Pac-Man and his email address. But at 15, he knows that won't look good on job applications.
Yeah, I got to make a new one because you need to grow out of it and to show that you can be mature and presentable.
Until recently, it's been okay for Johnson to be more kid than adult. But now that he wants a job, he basically has to rebrand himself for an unfamiliar world. Career counselor Marty Nimco says it can be an awkward transition for teens. But some things are pretty common sense.
Well, you don't want your butt crack to show.
Meaning you shouldn't sag your pants when going for an interview. Wardrobe malfunctions happen all the time. Teens mistake fancy dress for clothes they'd wear to the club or go in showing off their tattoos and piercings. Nimco also says young people have to strike a balance between cocky and confident.
As capable as any 17 or 18-year-old is, there really are a few things that one could learn. But you also don't want to be a little wimp and just sound desperate. I'll take anything. I'll do anything.
But most jobless teens would do anything to land an interview. Ironically, though, high schoolers Johnson and Wright say the interview process is what freaks them out the most.
They make me nervous because you never know what they're going to ask you.
And you don't want to take too long to answer a question or stutter, mumble your words.
One way to avoid stuttering, says Marty Nimco, is to prepare. Go in knowing something about the company and have what he calls a PAR story. That stands for Problem, Approach, Resolution.
Let's say in your school, they were doing a fundraiser to pay for the school play.
And instead of a bake sale or a car wash, you came up with an idea to have the actors perform scenes on the street.
That's clever. And then if you say we raised $700 as a result of it, but you stated the problem, how you approached it, and the positive result, having a few of those are usually quite impressive to employers.
But back at the high school, Marina Wright says her friends aren't quite living up to that ideal. Most are so nervous to talk to employers, they don't even put their own phone number on job applications. Instead, they list their parents.
You think that's a good idea?
No, it's not, because your parents aren't trying to get the job you are, so why would they want to speak to your mom or dad?
So maybe the first piece of advice for teen job seekers is to cut the cord. In Oakland, I'm Ashley Williams for Marketplace.
Ashley's story from our series Jobstacles comes to us from Youth Radio's New Options Desk. Think of pretty much every partisan issue you can imagine. And at the root of it, at the very bottom, is money and how the government spends it. Not very wisely is the conclusion of an article in the latest edition of The Atlantic magazine. Peter Orszag, who used to run the Office of Management and Budget for President Obama, and John Bridgeland, he was the director of the White House Domestic Policy Council for President George W. Bush, argue that the government should use more data to figure out where to spend money and where not to. That Uncle Sam should moneyball it, if you will. Gentlemen, it's good to have you with us.
Nice to be with you.
Good to be with you.
So I'm going to ask you, Peter, this first question, just because somebody has to answer it. Where you been, man, with this idea that the government's not spending money effectively? You go out on Main Street and people will start nodding their heads very quickly.
Well, I think there's a broad understanding that the government could spend money better. But what we're really focused on here is using evidence and data to do that. Our estimates suggest that less than $1 out of 100 that the government spends is backed by any solid evidence that it actually achieves its objectives. And that's way too low a share.
John, you guys use in your piece as an example the Scared Straight program, where you show kids videos of and you introduce them to people who have been in jail. And the theory is they learn that jail's a bad place to be, and so they don't want to go to jail. You point out that data shows it's actually not working to keep kids out of jail, and yet it still gets money. So how do you convince a congressman in I don't know, the 3rd Texas Congressional District who runs one of these Scared Straight programs, how do you convince him to cut funding with something in his district?
Kai, that's exactly the problem and the political challenge. Another example was the Even Start Family Literacy Program.
trouble was multiple evaluations showed that the people who weren't in that program were doing just as well as those who were. Notwithstanding that, it was the legacy of a very well-respected former superintendent, teacher, and member of Congress. And literally after that evidence was produced showing the program didn't work, Congress continued to spend more than $1 billion over 8 years before it finally defunded the program.
And I feel like I should come up with a question here, but I really can't, because the only thing to do is slap your head and list this along with the $600 toilet seats and the tanker airplanes that the Pentagon doesn't want, that the Congress insists on, Peter. So what are we to do when Congress does not have the strength of will to make these decisions?
One possibility is we could have a Moneyball index for votes. So if you're consistently voting for things that have been shown not to work, the public should know that, and it would be not too difficult to put together an index of voting patterns, and the hope would be that that would pressure members of Congress to stop behaving that way.
Public shaming.
Public shaming.
Here's the thing, though, John, about Moneyball. Billy Beane, when he was running the Oakland A's and famously did what Michael Lewis wrote about and took a bunch of no-names and analyzed the data and got them to the playoffs, he had autonomy of action. Right. He could decide to do something and do it. That's just flat, as you guys both know, that's just flat not the way Washington works.
It's true. But I think it's not a partisan issue. You know, Republicans are looking for a way to constrain the growth of government spending. And we're an environment of sequester and fiscal austerity. And Democrats, frankly, are looking to preserve the integrity of social programs that, you know, show the power and reach and effectiveness of government.
Bearing in mind, Peter, that Congress really never does anything, Washington never does anything until its back is against the wall. And as we are, as you guys say in this piece, in this era of fiscal scarcity, right, there's just not a whole lot of money to go around. What is at risk if we don't start measuring and making these admittedly hard decisions?
I guess there are two things that are at risk. One is that we cut muscle instead of fat. That we, as we make these fiscal adjustments, we're getting rid of things that do work well, and then perhaps more importantly, when a program doesn't work, ultimately the people who are hurt are the people who would have been helped if the program did work.
Peter Orszag used to run the Congressional Budget Office and the Office of Management and Budget, most recently under President Obama. John Bridgeland used to be the director of the White House Domestic Policy Council under President George W. Bush. Their article on whether the government can play money ball or not, how it spends its money, is in the new issue of The Atlantic Magazine. Guys, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Kai.
Thank you.
The passing of James Gandolfini yesterday has, of course, turned popular culture back to the show he starred in, The Sopranos, the way it changed television and the business of television. Marketplace's Adrian Hill has more.
This is The Sopranos Story. It's a story of a bad guy with sad eyes that you can't help but root for.
It was the very first show that dared to present a main character who was basically unredeemable.
Elaine Rapping is a professor emeritus at SUNY Buffalo.
He's a sociopath.
And one that paved the way for characters like Walter White on Breaking Bad, Don Draper from Mad Men. But creating an anti-hero is only the beginning of the TV lawbreaking.
The Sopranos really changed everything about television.
Next time on The Sopranos Story. Previously on The Sopranos Story.
He's a sociopath.
The Sopranos created the rise of the TV bad guy that we root for. But it also changed everything else, including TV's rigid storytelling structures. Tim Malloy is TV editor at TheWrap.com.
The Sopranos really threw all of that out and gave other shows the freedom to throw all of that out.
And along with it, they threw out the old school TV business model. Next time on The Sopranos Story. Previously on The Sopranos Story.
That was completely revolutionary.
The Sopranos revolutionized characters, story development, but also the TV industry. Gary Edgerton is a communication professor at Butler University and author of a book on The Sopranos.
If people were to look for breakout programming, they were no longer it was no longer worthwhile to look to the broadcast networks.
The Sopranos also showed you could spend big money on TV and it'd pay off, making a lot of today's TV better. Don't stop.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, in which the truth about Google and its notorious, nay, ridiculous job interviews finally comes out. For the uninitiated, the biggest search firm in the world is infamous for its, shall we say, tortured job interview questions. To wit, this is an actual question. You are shrunk to the height of a nickel, and your mass is proportionally reduced so as to maintain your original density. You are then thrown into an empty glass blender. The blades will start moving in 60 seconds. What do you do? So that's the question. Here's the follow-up. I read in the pages of the New York Times today this quote from Laszlo Bock, Senior Vice President of People Operations at Google. Quote, "We found that brain teasers are a complete waste of time. How many golf balls can you fit into an airplane? How many gas stations in Manhattan? They don't predict anything. They serve primarily to make the interviewer feel smart." Gotta love HR, right? All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM today. The Dow tumbled 2.33%, 353 points. The NASDAQ off 2.25%, 78 points. The S&P 500 erased 2.5% or 40 points. And let's remember, people, Ben Bernanke said the economy is getting better. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, George Judson, Jonathan Karp, Ethan Lindsay, Sylvester Monroe, Betsy Streisand, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Sarah Gilbert. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you back here tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.